Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
I had dinner the other night with the head of Pfizer, the head of Eli Lilly, and RFK, as you know, and Oz. And we had, and other people within the administration that are involved in the medical. And we're looking to find out.
Talking about the increasing ratio of autism in children. At a recent press conference in Palm Beach, Florida, President-elect Donald Trump.
You know, if you look at autism, so 30 years ago we had, I've heard numbers of like 1 in 200,000, 1 in 100,000. And now I'm hearing numbers of 1 in 100. So something's wrong. There's something wrong. And we're going to find out about it.
This is Agriculture Today.
The U.S. economy has shown surprising resilience through the end of 2024.
Greg Lyons is a senior economist with the Farm Credit Administration at the Farm Credit System's recent monthly meeting.
The latest estimates for Q3 growth were 3%, with slightly slower estimates for Q4. And one of the dominant explanations for this robust has been productivity growth that we've seen, which is a strong underlying basis for economic expansion. Now, due in part to this, we've seen that many economists are forecasting that the U.S. economy will remain in positive, though slower growth in 2025. Now, productivity growth is also a strong support for real wage growth, and we have seen that personal consumption has been behind much of the economic expansion that we've seen throughout 2024. Critically for agriculture, what we have seen is continued expansion in spending at food at home and food away from home. And food away from home is critically important for segments such as cattle and dairy producers who are highly reliant on that sort of spending. Now, there have been some warning signs for lower income households. We've seen that credit card delinquencies are at their highest level since 2011. Real median household income is below 2019 levels. And in general, lower income households have been the most exposed to fast growing costs, such as housing cost increases.
On the topic of inflation,
we have seen headline inflation continue to fall, though more stable measures show modest residual inflation. Now, we did see in yesterday's report that overall CPI did tick up modestly, while core inflation did remain flat. But what we have seen is that over the last 6 months, we have seen that energy cost declines have been largely behind the decline in overall inflation. But core inflation, which strips out the more volatile components of energy costs and food costs, has been driven in large part by increase in shelter costs. Now, we did receive good news yesterday where shelter cost growth did continue to decline. And we are seeing some positive growth, especially for rental markets, where new lease cost growth has been flat through the back half of 2024. And the hope is that that will continue to influence cost growth next year. Now, housing markets are a little more tight, where we have seen continued elevated building costs and high lending rates continue to place pressure on that market. There have been slight increases in the number of homes up for sale, but that section of cost growth will remain a little more under pressure heading into next year.
And what about labor markets?
After several years of tight condition, we're approximating something that is much more typical. On the left-hand chart here, you'll note that job openings in that black line there is just about equal to total unemployment level. That's the first time outside of 2020 that we've experienced that since 2017. And on the right-hand chart, what we are seeing is that nominal wage growth has continued to come down. Real wage growth still does remain positive at about 2% per year, well in line with historic averages. Now, we did see a job report last week where we did see an additional 250,000 jobs added. However, there were some concerning signs. When we looked a little closer at the report, we have seen that labor force participation rates have declined very mildly. However, I would note that there is an increasing strain on those who are currently out of the workforce as the median duration of unemployment has continued to rise, and the number of long-term unemployed, those unemployed for 26 weeks or longer, has also continued to decline or increase.
And the potential of a Fed rate decision.
Now, this decline in both inflation and the softening of the labor market has led the Federal Reserve to emphasize the importance of its dual mandate. In its November communications, there were several critical phrases. One is the Federal Reserve is telegraphing that they have gained confidence that inflation is on a sustainable path back to 2%. And they're also noting that current productivity growth is supportive of the wage growth that we are seeing. Now, since the latest FOMC projections were released in September, markets have become a little more bearish on rate reductions.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
We'll soon unleash American energy, and this will be done at levels not seen before, issuing quick approvals for pipelines, drilling, and other infrastructure.
At a press conference in Palm Beach, Florida, President-elect Donald Trump on what's coming in the next administration.
It'll be clean energy, and we'll bring in the price of electricity, and we're going to bring it down fast. We're also going to create clean coal. Clean coal is something that has really taken over. We have coal that will last for over 1,000 years. We have so much coal, and with a process, it becomes clean coal. It's very powerful energy, unlike wind. It's very, very powerful, and we're going to be doing a lot of clean coal for the people of West Virginia and others, Wyoming, so many states. We have great states, and they'll be happy to hear it, but we're going to be very much into clean coal. I don't ever use the word coal. I use the word clean coal. And I'll keep my promise to pass historic tax cuts for American families, workers, and businesses that create jobs in America. As you know, we're giving tax cuts if they do it here. We brought it down from 44%, 42%. In some cases, it was 39%. We brought it all the way down to 21%. And now we're bringing it down to 15%, but only if they make their product, their car, or whatever they're doing in the United States, in the U.S., and people are thrilled. I've had the smartest people on Wall Street call me. They said, "Where did you get that idea?" And it doesn't seem that complicated, right? But it's like the paperclip. Nobody ever thought of it. One guy thought of it. Everybody looked at it. They said, "Wow, that was a good idea. Why didn't I think of it?" But we're bringing it down 6 more points, and that will put us really at the best level we've ever had for bringing in business. We've never been down to that level. We'll be among the lowest taxed states, and a lot of businesses are going to come in. Between that and our taxing and tariff policies, we're going to have business like nobody's ever seen in this country before. That's why we're, you know, having a 41-year record in optimism from small businesses and big businesses. And I'll keep my promise to pass historic tax cuts for families, workers, and businesses that create jobs in America. Any business that invests $1 billion or more in the United States will be eligible for fully expedited permits and approvals, including environmental approvals from the federal government. So when companies come in, if they're going to invest $1 billion or more, there'll be many of them, and they'll go into Detroit, and they'll go into a lot of places where we want them. You saw how well I did with the auto workers. We did unbelievably. You saw how well we did with the Teamsters and also the non-union were record 98%, 97%. Nobody's ever got numbers like that because we're bringing business back, and they're all coming back. We lost them over years of stupidity, I call it the years of stupidity, the decades of stupidity. Through the Department of Government Efficiency, Elon Musk has been working very hard with various people, including Vivek. We're going to eliminate hundreds of billions of dollars of waste and fraud. And I can only tell you, I'll give you a little early report, they're finding things that you wouldn't even believe. So we're looking to save maybe $2 trillion. And it'll have no impact. Actually, it'll make life better, but it'll have no impact on people. It's not like we will never cut Social Security or things like that. It's just waste, fraud, and abuse. And we'll immediately restore the sovereign borders of the United States and stop illegal immigration, which is costing us, I believe, trillions of dollars a year.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Let me talk about the dispute settlement system at the WTO.
U.S. Trade Ambassador Catherine Tai talking about reform of the appellate process at the World Trade Organization.
First, put it in the context that the dispute settlement system doesn't exist in a vacuum, that it is part of the larger WTO institution that we value very, very much for what it stands for how it brings together 164 economies in the world and provides us with a forum for dealing with each other and being able to communicate with each other and to resolve the disputes that we have when they come up. So the reform of the WTO dispute settlement system is tied to the consensus at the WTO that the entire WTO ought to be reformed. to reflect the economy that we're living in today, and also to be able to keep up with the changes in our economy since the WTO was established almost 30 years ago. So on WTO reform broadly, because I also want to make very clear, the United States and our team at the mission to the WTO in Geneva is engaging across the board. We have a special responsibility on dispute settlement, but we are engaging at the committee level. We are bringing written proposals every meeting, and we're also leaning in on how to make this a more functional negotiating forum.
And Ambassador, you know my fixation also on the clock.
On the clock, here we go. On dispute settlement, what we are doing is we are seeking a system that is singularly focused on helping two parties resolve a trade dispute, to be a dispute settlement system. As the system was intended, dispute settlement has evolved into an avenue for judicial rulemaking. It has become synonymous with litigation, very expensive and time-consuming litigation, to your point about the clock. It allows countries to seek through litigation what they could not accomplish by negotiation. So the results have significantly damaged U.S. interests through an interpretation that, for example, shields China's non-market practices and undermines our ability to defend U.S. workers and businesses. You may also be aware of the recent national security decisions that have come out of the WTO system that are deeply concerning to us and to our national security sovereignty. We are engaging on a reform process that requires 164 economies and members of the WTO to agree. And this is not about us dictating the terms. It is about us being very honest about what our interests are, what we need the dispute settlement system to do for us, but also to craft a renewed and better dispute settlement system with our partners at the WTO.
Testifying last year before Congress with Arizona Representative David Schweiker.
Ambassador Tai, as the conversations continued for the last few years, I know a number of our EU trading partners, even some of our free market economies in Asia, have the same concerns as you've articulated, we've articulated. I understand this is supposed to be a consensus operation. But at some point, we have some bad actors who may not join that consensus. How do we use our ultimate leverage that the vast majority of the world's trading partners believe that the reforms are necessary?
Yes, we have consensus around the fact that reforms are necessary. It's reflected in the MC12 joint statement that came out. The hard work comes now in terms of actually doing the reform. And I want to assure you that our very dedicated team, led by our ambassador to the WTO, Ambassador Maria Pagan, is doing that every single day in Geneva.
Please let us know what we can do to be help, but to move it along. At some point, the calcification of this discussion is getting tiresome.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
The USDA released its latest projection for farm income in early December, and they found that while aggregate farm incomes were forecast to decline only $6 billion and still remained well above historic averages, this really understates a sharp divergence in the experience of crop and livestock producers that we're going to see in 2024.
Craig Lyons is a senior economist with the Farm Credit Administration.
Crop receipts fell $32 billion in 2024 relative to 2023, while livestock receipts rose $15 billion. Now, a reduction in expense is forecast to help all producers. We're seeing large declines in expenses for feed, fertilizer, and fuels, although there are still some increasing costs for things such as interest on debt or on labor costs. Now, at an aggregate level, we can look at this and say that liquidity and profitability ratios for the sector have been largely stable. Solvency ratios are improving, but these aggregate stories really are masking a subsector strain.
On the topic of net cash farm income,
the USDA began generating this series back in 2010, and they are forecasting that in 2024, corn and soybean producers will see their lowest average net cash farm income since they began this series in 2010. The primary driver for this is that while prices have retreated back to late 2020 levels, input expenses, critically for things such as fertilizer, are still well above the levels they were in 2020. So margin compression is going to be a key story for cash grain producers in the 24-25 crop marketing year. Turning to livestock, that sharp decline in feed costs has led to generally strong returns across the sector, with cattle and dairy producers experiencing very strong producers and lower but positive returns elsewhere. We are seeing the exports are also generally supportive for producers across the livestock sector. There are going to be some concerning signs due to things like HPAI, but the USDA began to set collections of milk next week for testing of HPAI, and also seeing continued impacts to livestock or poultry operations across the country over the last 30 days. For fruit and tree nuts, what we have seen is that while there has been modest increases in aggregate levels of prices, we are seeing a lot of variability across the sector here. For things such as pistachios and almonds, we've seen that increases in exports have offset increases in production, and prices continue to decline, increase from very low levels those producers experienced over the last several years. Elsewhere across fruits and nuts, most of the variation is attributable either to commodity-specific impacts, such as greening in Florida, or to regional weather-related impacts, such as those from Hurricane Milton.
One area of concern for producers has been increasing input cost.
So for input costs such as feed, what we've seen is that producers are back to experiencing the cost they did before the start of this agricultural cycle in 2020, while fertilizer costs remain elevated. But I do want to call out labor and interest costs that have continued to rise through the entire agricultural cycle. This is why for dairy and cattle producers who are mostly related to feed expenses that we've seen those sharp increases in returns, while cash grain producers are facing more margin compression. But I really do want to call out specialty producers, that's fruits, tree nuts, and vegetables. These producers are highly exposed to increases in labor costs, so the continued increase in costs through the entire agricultural cycle will lead to additional margin compression for these producers.
Finally, he looks at weather conditions.
Weather conditions in the U.S. Were slightly dry at the end of the growing season. Those conditions have alleviated. There were dry pastures either in the northern plains and in the southwest. But we have seen those dry conditions alleviate, especially in the northern plains, and we haven't seen any impacts to things such as hay prices for cattle producers. We've also seen some alleviation of transportation-related issues in the Mississippi River.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
We will definitely have a slightly bigger crop than we had in 23.
Sean Wade is Director of Policy Analysis and Research with Plains Cotton Growers.
You know, for the 24 crop, you know, somewhere around probably 2 to 2.25 million bales, somewhere in that neighborhood, you know, close to that 225,000, 2.25 million bales. But we are, you know, it is, you know, for a crop that's really not of significant size, the harvest season has, you know, kind of drug out. We've had some rainfall off and on, you know, since the first part of October, late September, that has certainly delayed the harvest activity in a couple of spots for, you know, a week to 2 weeks at a time. So we are on the downhill stretch, I believe, as when it comes to harvest, but still a lot more acres maybe than we anticipated still are in limbo as far as whether they will be harvested or won't be harvested. And that is, you know, kind of a situation that is being kind of illustrated very clearly in the Farm Service Agency certified acreage report data that they release every month. We've seen here on the High Plains, those failed acre numbers gradually climbing since August, as we anticipated that they would. But we still kind of haven't reached the level that we thought we might get to when it comes to how many acres will ultimately be failed. If you look at, you know, just by the numbers, about 45% of the High Plains dryland acres have already been failed, but we could still see, you know, a few more added to that total as we go through this month of December. On the irrigated side, we've seen a few additions to the failed acre number on the irrigated side as well. So we're up to about 18% failed acres on irrigated. And that kind of combines for an overall abandonment number right now of just under 35%, which certainly not too bad, but, you know, most of those acres have not really yielded anywhere near where growers needed them to for the expenses that they had to put into them this year. And you can kind of carry that out to the state as well, the state level, where, you know, we've seen those failed acre numbers, you know, continue to go up, but still haven't quite reached the level that USDA NAS folks have been projecting in their crop production reports. If you look at the NAS data, they're saying we would harvest around 3.65 million acres. Right now, the FSA data shows there's still about 4 million acres out there in Texas to be harvested. So pretty interesting just to kind of see kind of where it'll all end up and see if those FSA and NAS numbers kind of do come together. But, you know, we are seeing, you know, this Texas crop get a little bit smaller as we kind of have gone through the harvest period. Right now, the state's only projected to produce about 3.9 million bales of cotton for 2024.
So what about 2025?
Crop, you know, prices across the board are down. And so, you know, we really would anticipate that, you know, those dynamics, they're just not one that's going to drag a lot of acres to it, especially here in the state of Texas. Now, you know, elsewhere where they can maybe do a little bit more corn or peanuts or something like that, we could definitely see, you know, maybe some acres get shifted around. But, you know, I guess as an early look right now, well, where those markets are and kind of what we would be anticipating for crop insurance pricing and that sort of thing, I would anticipate very similar planted acreage numbers for cotton and other crops in Texas at this point.
Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
It is a very important technique in terms of range management in the Flint Hills, because if those Flint Hills are, if those pastures are not managed, then we end up with all types of brush and trees and invasive species, and the quality of the pasture that the cattle are grazing on diminishes significantly.
Washburn University Law Specialist Roger McOwen.
So burning of those pastures really makes the grass much more vibrant. You can put more weight on cattle faster. It's a great economic practice. It's also good for the range management scientists will tell you it's very good for the overall ecology of the Flint Hills. But from what I deal with on my side of these things is what's the potential risk, liability risk, legal risk that a farmer or rancher has when you engage in those situations. And this was highlighted recently because of a major accident on an interstate in downstate Illinois, in the rural part of Illinois, where there was a lot of blowing dirt from soil in farm fields adjacent to the interstate that created, in essence, blackout conditions on the interstate. And you had a massive, some accounts said that the vehicles that crashed were 90 vehicles, and then you had some deaths. And so the questions I started getting was, well, are the farmers potentially liable for those injuries and deaths caused by the dirt from their fields blowing across the interstate and obscuring visibility, which is what the state patrol said was the cause? And basically, the answer to that is no, farmer is not, in that situation, would not be responsible for death or damages sustained by motorists because of that blowing dirt from the field. But there could be, and this is where we can tie it back to pasture burning in the Flint Hills, there could be monetary fines for violating a soil erosion statute, or you could have loss of farm program benefits for being out of compliance with a conservation plan. Now, Kansas has a soil erosion statute. A lot of the states in the Midwest and the Plain states do, and those statutes date back to the Dust Bowl days of the 1930s. So you could potentially, a farmer, say, in Illinois, could be fined for not following good husbandry practices, good farm management practices, good farming practices, and failing to plant a cover crop over the winter, or improperly preparing the seed bed, those types of things. But there wouldn't be liability for the blowing of the dirt, because this was a windstorm that came through, excessive high winds. We can't control that. But again, there might be the potential for fines or loss of federal farm program benefits if you're out of compliance with your conservation plan for your farm. And that's kind of that's what's happened in some cases. The Iowa statute was challenged as unconstitutional back in 1979, but it was upheld against that challenge. And we've had, you know, fines asserted with respect to smoke blowing across roadways in Kansas from pasture burns, but not so much on the liability side of things, the civil or criminal liability. It's just more of a fine for not following the administrative rules when you conduct a controlled burn. It's always important to use good farming practices if we're talking about soil erosion. That will always help minimize the type of situation that occurred in Illinois. But again, you can't control the weather. And the same thing would apply with respect to pasture burning. You want to use common sense. You want to follow the administrative rules that are there and make sure if you're burning pastures, you've got the appropriate backfire has been burned. You're not burning when the winds are above a certain amount. You're not burning when they're too low. You want to have the winds right. You want to have them out of the right direction when you start. be able to control if the winds switch on you, notify local law enforcement. This is all in the reg. So make sure you're aware of what the any applicable regs are, whether it's a soil erosion statute or whether it's controlled burning regulations. Make sure you're in compliance with those, and then use common sense and always use good farming practices. And I think that's the big takeaway.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Pork production lowered 40 million pounds based on lighter weights. We expect that to carry into 2025. Not much change to our broiler forecast. We did increase our first quarter broiler production forecast based on recent hatchery data and made some small changes to our turkey production forecast as well based on hatchery data and into 2025, reflecting some recent HPAI events that have led to some culling.
That's World Ag Outlook Board Chairman, Dr. Mark Jekinowski.
Prices. We've been seeing some strength in hog prices lately. We raised our hog price forecast for 2024 by 50 cents per hundredweight, $61.55. And we expect that strength to carry into 2025, where we raised that price by $3.25 per hundredweight to $62.25 per hundredweight. Also seeing a little bit of strength in turkey prices as well, which we reflected in modestly higher price forecasts there.